let's start. I'd like to hear about test scores. We know all schools have to test in order to receive federal assistance, and that each year it seems like, you know, test scores indicate that the system, the education system in West Virginia, is maybe not as effective as other states. But, you know, I've spoken with one educator in particular who says that if you compare West Virginia to other rural poor states, so in other words, apples to apples, that we're actually doing pretty well despite the challenges that we face. So I'm just curious, how do you look at these test scores? You know, which scores are you looking at, and what do they tell you about our overall system?
At the end of my tenure as superintendent, the first go-around, I served on the NAGB board, which is the governing board, the National Assessment Governing Board for the NAEP assessment, which captures a lot of attention when those scores come out. It is not intended to be a test where you do state rankings. That's not at all a valid use of the test, yet many groups do that. So if you do subscribe to state rankings on the NAEP test, in elementary school in grades 4, in reading and mathematics, we're approximately ranked 36th through 38th in the country. One of our department staff likes to say, we're out punching our weight class, so to speak, because when you consider the strongest determinant external to the school that affects student achievement, it's mother's education level, closely followed by the father's, closely followed by poverty. And when you look at those numbers, our adults are unfortunately the most poorly educated general population of any state in the country. They have we have fewer adults with associate or bachelor degrees than any state in the country. So if you follow the logic that goes along with that, you would assume that we'd be ranked 49th or 50th in student achievement, and we're not. So it indicates that we're outperforming our mean per capita income level, our educational levels of adults, but it's still not good enough. And then the other interesting discussion is that the U.S. Department of Education does in fact require us to have a statewide, what we call summative attestment. It typically is the course or the assessment at the end of the year that we give to all students in grades 3 through 8, and then in West Virginia in grade 11. And that's the assessment that I indicated. We've seen some slight improvement. We have a long way to go, but we're really, really honing in and working hard on mathematics, and we expect to see some improvement over the next couple of years. It's a 5-year initiative, and we're excited to see what kind of progress we might realize there. Now, if we talk about authentic assessments, I'm not a real subscriber of standardized tests to judge the quality of a system at all. And I formerly worked with a national organization that consisted of major companies. They don't really subscribe to standardized test score results to dictate the kind and be predictive of the kinds of skills that they need in employees. They want kids that can critically think and problem solve. They want kids that are creative, that can communicate in oral and written form, and who, most importantly, and this is really interesting to me, who are collaborators, who know how to work with others and know how to work well and productively. In addition, they need some academic skill level to be attained. But 92% of our business say that skill level in mathematics only consists of a good solid understanding of what we would term and how we've organized math in Algebra 1. Now that's a real interesting discussion, because the minute that we start referring to reducing the level of mathematics attainment by course in West Virginia, critics come forward and say, you're not teaching trig anymore? You're not requiring kids to go through statistics? And statistics might be a very important course today in terms of data analysis and application of big data. But some of that content today appears to not be nearly as important to business and industry as it once was.
Trying to get a handle on teacher shortages, Last year, it was reported that there were some, 700 vacancies, although finding the actual numbers I've found is kind of tricky. So I'm just wondering, do you know where we are this year as far as teacher shortages, and how does the state cope with those?
I think a lot of the issue with teacher shortage is creating a common language. Those 700 vacancies aren't empty classrooms. They're vacancies where we don't have certified teachers in those classrooms, in most cases.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually to the point in some places of looking for mature adults that will man those classrooms and then obtain certification once they get there. I am deeply appreciative of adults that man those classrooms that may not have been trained professionally to be math teachers. But the fact of the matter is they're teaching a content area that they have not had the opportunity in most cases to be fully trained in. So we have created some online courses for teachers not only in secondary schools. We have about approximately 60 teachers who have signed up for the courses, and they're basically crash courses in Algebra 1 and Geometry, where they can obtain content as quickly and as responsibly as we can possibly provide it, so that they can go back and offer higher quality instruction to our kids, you know, in terms of them grasping and understanding content differently and knowing how to teach that content differently.
Well, let's talk a little bit about absenteeism then. It was reported 38% of schools aren't meeting attendance standards. I know this is a concern of yours, and also teacher absenteeism. You were vocal about this last year as well. So what do we know about how absent teachers are? I mean, you talk about some counties increasing the money that they spend on substitute teachers, you know, that figure has tripled. How are we facing that challenge?
I'll start with students first. It was extremely troubling when the data came in for what we call our balanced scorecard. It's the accountability mechanism that we're required to report out by the federal government. And whereas we went up in almost all the other indicators, that was an area where we declined. And why it's troubling is that we made that, and our districts and our schools, I thought, made that a priority to work on last year. And yet performance levels went down. We are analyzing as to why that occurred, but nevertheless, the numbers are deplorable, and there's no other way to say it. And is the school responsible for that? Well, you could say yes, in part. But the problem is parents or guardians or somebody need to get up in the morning, need to get their kids prepared for school, and need to get them to school and make sure that they go to school, period.
Well, I mean, but let me just interject here. I mean, yeah, we know that parents need to get their kids in and what have you, but doesn't it also reflect that maybe schools' environments aren't a place that kids want to be? You know, I mean, if kids wanted to be there, wouldn't that help?
I think that your point is well taken, and it's a fair point. If we make school an attractive and inviting place, if instruction in every classroom is engages kids actively, I mean, you know, let's face it, our kids grow up in a very digital world right now. The stimuli that affects our kids today requires almost a song and dance by a classroom teacher who is well-trained, who can compete with the kind of stimuli that kids go through with their iPhones or their smartphones or computers or their digital worlds today. So it's a challenge, and it's a tremendous challenge. And yes, I think there's an obligation on behalf of all of our teachers, our administrators, myself, our Department of Ed, local boards of education, to make sure that we're delivering the kind of education that is enticing and attracts kids. Having said that, I can't tell you how proud I am of the numerous classrooms and schools that do, in fact, make school a very warm and inviting place. We have teachers that care deeply about their kids. And so if we can just figure out a way for the successful 80% or whatever of our schools, for all of that secret formula, if you will, or or their strategies to be captured by those that aren't doing so right now, we would be very well served. You know, we've called on district administrators and local boards of education to step up their role. We don't educate these kids. We don't manage their schools in Charleston. We do a lot of policy. We provide supports. And we've been challenged by the governor and the legislature to allow for much more local flexibility. My mantra is clearly this: local flexibility brings robust accountability. So they have the flexibility. Now it's time to step up and show the responsibility and the accountability for performance in the schools. And so that means that we're going to have to step up, and we've tried to be very, very supportive. We may have to, you know, alter the way that we monitor the situation and deal with consequences for those that are chronic offenders that can't meet any kind of a responsible standard with attendance. That goes for teachers too. A 93% attendance rate for teachers to me is abysmal.
Sure. Well, you mentioned that you made this a priority, dealing with absenteeism. How have you made that a priority? What has been implemented? What policies have been implemented?
Well, we have really made this a priority as we've met with superintendents, as we meet with attendance directors. They've clearly understood it's been a State Board of Education priority. And we have not done much in terms of stepping up or modifying or altering our attendance policies and so forth. Frankly, we're going there next. And we thought we'd take the approach to encourage and point out the problem through exposing the data, being transparent with the data, pointing out the problem, trusting our local administrators, our principals, our local boards of education, and our teachers to really step up the effort to get kids to come to school, working with their parents and their communities. It hasn't worked. And so we are not going to go through this school year without addressing some mechanism and policy for enforcement of attendance laws and attendance performance.
You know, you spoke a little bit about legislation and the legislation that passed this summer. What are your biggest concerns or interests going forward now that bill has passed?
I want to applaud the legislature for providing $30.5 million to address what we call the social, emotional, mental health needs of our children. And we've identified some of that already in terms of kids that come from opioid addiction backgrounds or perhaps addictions themselves. Recently, DHHR has talked about the number of runaway foster care children. It's a major problem. The exponential rise with the neonatal abstinence children, and the implications that they're growing up and entering our school systems. This money can be spent by our districts in a very flexible manner. We provided them with guidelines to say, take that money and spend it very wisely by analyzing your data in your school districts and in your schools and figuring out how to best utilize that money to support the needs of those kids.
I want to transfer now to the question of charter schools, which is, of course, a really big, a very hot point with the legislation. Have you heard from county boards of education or superintendents who are considering charter options at this point?
We've done some work in discussing with broad representation from stakeholders, both pro-charter and both against charter. We spent a lot of time asking them, because the state board needs to develop a policy around charter schools, what their thoughts and their ideas are around the issue. We invited some superintendents and boards where we suspected there could be a request for charter schools to come forward from local boards of education. Mm-hmm. And I have not heard one yet that is really interested in moving forward with a charter school concept. It's a little bit still early, and there may be those that wait for the state board policy to be developed. We'll be fast-tracking that within the next 6 months to get out there. I've talked to one district superintendent who there had been some interest, but they basically have said that they're not interested. They're interested in the innovation that goes along that sometimes is used as a reason to do a charter school, but they're not interested in starting a charter school. That was a very, very divisive issue. And right. If I thought that charter schools were the absolute solution to improving student achievement in our state for all of our students, I would have jumped behind it, but I've just simply read too much research and too much behind the whole notion of charter schools. There are some that work. There are some that don't work. They reflect basically what happens in every one of our schools.
Are there goals or ideas or legislation or bills that you would like to see going forward into our next legislative session?
I'm looking forward to no legislation right now, quite frankly. We've had enough. We need to get our feet underneath us.
Mm-hmm.
We need to implement good faith and with good fidelity of implementation, and maybe give us a chance to do that implementation without distraction, where we don't have to go through proposed walkouts or controversial issues such as charter schools or savings accounts or whatever it might be.
Right.
And let us just get about the business of educating our children to the best of our ability.